Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas.
Leading Ideas Talks is also brought to you by the adult Christian study, Journey Through the Psalms, now available in a download version that you may use with your online groups during this time of social distancing. Journey Through the Psalms is only $5 for a limited time. Learn more at churchleadership.com/studies. How can your church help congregants deal with fears, anxiety, and economic stresses in this unprecedented time? In this episode, we speak with Wesley Theological Seminary Professor Michael Koppel about congregational care needs and responses in light of the challenges of the coronavirus crisis.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary. I'm also editor of Leading Ideas e-newsletter, and I'm pleased to be the host for this episode of Leading Ideas Talks. I'm joined today by Dr. Michael Koppel, who teaches pastoral theology and congregational care at Wesley Theological Seminary. Michael is an ordained teaching elder in the Presbyterian Church USA. And we've asked Michael to be our guest today to help all of us think about how churches and church leaders can respond to the tremendous pastoral challenges we're facing in light of the current coronavirus crisis. As we're talking today, people in many major cities across the United States are told to shelter in place. Churches across America have suspended their worship gatherings and other forms of face-to-face ministry. And yet at the same time, our congregations and communities are dealing with unprecedented health fears and anxieties and economic stress. So we're not only facing unprecedented problems, but we're having to figure out new and different ways of responding to them. So this is really an important conversation, Michael, and I'm so glad that you're willing to talk with us and our listeners today.
Well, thank you very much, Anne. I appreciate it, too. I share with all of our listeners and with you the anxiety and fear and tension that goes with this experience. We are in uncharted territory, uncharted waters, and I would never think of myself as an expert in this kind of environment. We are all learning together how it is we can do the best possible thing for our community and for our families and for ourselves.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think we're all having to figure out new things as we're going along. But just to begin, what's foremost on your mind as we come into this conversation?
Foremost to my mind, I think, is just is one of the that piece right there, is that we're novices trying to make our way through it. But what's foremost is the health and well-being of congregations and pastors and my family and your family and economic well-being, and also primarily my focus is on those who are most vulnerable. At a time like this, we want to look out for ourselves, but we also want to look out for those who are most vulnerable and most likely to be harmed in a situation like this, which in some ways could be all of us at the health level.
Right. Well, one thing that's occurred to me as we are in this unprecedented time, that even thinking beyond the scale and the magnitude of the crisis, I'm wondering what you think are some different kinds of needs that might manifest themselves in this situation that are different than some of the day-to-day pastoral challenges that people are used to dealing with in congregational ministry. What are some things that you think pastors need to be on the lookout for?
Well, I think there are different needs, but I think one of the things pastors need to be on the lookout for is, and this is really goes without saying, but I'll say it, and that is the increased level of anxiety that we're working with. So one of the key pieces for pastoral leaders is how to be a non-anxious presence. How do you practice non-anxiously? Well, even in ordinary circumstances, it's hard to be non-anxious. So I always say to students and pastors, a little less anxious. We sometimes aren't even the ones who are the least anxious in the environment, but we want to practice with less anxiety. It helps to lower the barometer, lower the esteem. What's the metaphor I'm really searching for here? We want to ratchet down the temperature a bit But that's a very difficult thing to be able to do when anxiety is running so high in so many different directions. So I don't know that it's something different we need to do. I think we go back to the basics in a situation like this. And the basic is really monitoring our own anxiety as pastoral leaders, but also as congregants, to be able to monitor our anxiety and do things that help lower it for ourselves. And then when we can do that, we can probably reach out to others with a little bit less anxiety. But that requires some self-awareness. And anxiety sometimes means that we blow out self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. So what would some of the practices be that you would recommend?
Well, my own practice is just to regularly be attentive to my own body. And so I think that congregants and pastors can be regularly attentive to their own bodies. What does that mean? Like this morning, for example, I usually have my morning prayer at home, but I got up and I thought, you know what? Who knows what today is going to bring? And it seems like a good enough day to get out for a walk. So I went out for an hour walk this morning, and it helped to settle the anxiety that was already there when I woke up, because I woke up with dreams and nightmares. And I imagine that our pastoral leaders and congregation members are waking up with dreams and nightmares too. So the anxiety really is never leaves us. I think it's really omnipresent. So a grounding practice like walking can help with the anxiety. That's just one example. But I also want to say that, you know, one size doesn't fit all. Some people aren't walkers. Don't walk. Do something that's grounding for you. Maybe sitting by the back window or on the back porch, or drinking coffee quietly can be a grounding exercise. Mm. Or read. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, thank you. I was just going to say thank you for that, because I think it is, I think when our normal patterns of life get as disrupted as they have been in this period, you know, we have to rethink some of the patterns that would otherwise be normal for us, and find new ways of doing exactly what you're saying.
Well, and I like the way you just said it too, because rethink it. And at the same time, for those of us who are thinkers, and I share that with you and a lot of our congregational leaders, also don't overthink it. So like this example this morning, I looked out the window and I think, you know, I don't usually do this, but I stopped and said that that's what's needed. So rethink, but also don't think too hard about it. Because if we think too hard, we might not do the thing that's needed for ourselves or our congregation.
Mm-hmm. So I read something that caught my attention yesterday, and it was from a pastoral leader in another part of the country, and he was making some recommendations. And he said that in this situation, there are going to be people in need of pastoral care who aren't the people you normally think need it. And so I just wanted to throw that out to you for your reaction, and then also ask how pastors and congregations can have their antenna out for people who may need help, who may not be the people you normally think of when you're thinking about your pastoral care needs.
It's interesting. I wonder what the pastor meant by those who ordinarily need it.
I realize there is an assumption in that question, but so say what you mean, just that we're going to assume that everybody is needing special attention.
Well, I don't know that everybody needs special attention. I think maybe one of the things we can rely on, I think, but it helps me reframe, and for us to reframe what pastoral care's purpose is. I think if we think of course, we want to help people who are most in need, but what we see as a need might be our own need to respond to that person's need. In other words, can we see people's strengths and availability to, what I want to say, so we can start from their seeing their strengths. So people who are most in need, I'm still wrestling with the question, who wouldn't ordinarily think would need it? Who are people I'm wrestling with the question.
I appreciate you pushing back on that, because I'm a lay person. I've never been a pastor. I think I may have a somewhat stereotyped idea of pastoral care. When I think of pastoral care in our congregation, I think about, you know, them connect, our pastors connecting with older people or shut-ins or people who are in the hospital or going through certain life transitions, people who have sort of identifiable circumstances that suggests that they may need some support. And so that's probably a faulty premise on my part, and I apologize for that. But I think for a lot of people that is, that maybe even for congregants, that's who they think needs the pastor's attention, so.
Right, so you don't need to apologize so heavily there. I think that was where I was landing too. I was trying to think, well, shut-ins, older people, people who are homebound, let's use that language, hospitalized or in a life transition, but those would be all people who I would ordinarily think would need pastoral care. Mm-hmm. So my mind is now saying, well, where are these other needs for those who we wouldn't think would need it? But already, even the terrain that we just talked about raises really significant challenges, because visiting the homebound is now a challenge. I have a friend who's a hospice chaplain who's terrified to go into the home hospice situations where family members who have dying members of their family, and she's feeling challenged with going into that environment, but also bringing home to her spouse possibly the illness. So how do we do visitation in a time like this, especially when we think about people, we're having this conversation using technology, but there's big conversation now about having working with doctor's visits across computer screens. But this all assumes technology.
Right.
And not everybody has that kind of technology. So I think the people who most needed, the ones maybe don't even have the technological capacity to be able to receive care.
Or they can't use it. My father's in assisted living and he can't hear. Right. He doesn't understand when you show him a computer screen that he's not just looking at a picture, you know, and so they're saying, well, use Skype. And I'm like, no, that's not going to work as well as you think it might.
Right. Yeah. Right. Technology is stressful for us and we're middle-aged. And
right. Well, speak for yourself.
I'm middle-aged.
Listening is so important to this. I mean, we talked about having your antenna out, but listening is a key element of pastoral care. And so, I mean, we're not just having to think about different ways of how we're going to listen, but also different ways of what we're listening for. What listening practices would you recommend?
Well, that's a great question. I was thinking about part of it I alluded to earlier this morning. I was listening to myself, or I could say I was listening to the prompting of the Holy Spirit, looking out the window. So we listen, that kind of listening to our own bodies, also listening to the tone of our voices. So in a time of anxiety, the kind of listening we want to do is hearing what we're saying, but really paying attention to the emotional resonance of how we're saying it, but not just for ourselves, but listening to others and how their speech is encased in very emotional language, or they might not be using emotional words, but there's an emotional resonance to it. We want to be particularly attentive to it, especially like what you were just saying, if we're making pastoral contact or care contact with people across phone lines or Zoom connection or any other form of technology, we want to be really attentive to the emotional side of what's going on. Hmm. And also I want to say, this is a practice I've noticed in myself in the last week, is listening for our own grief, because this experience of having the world turned upside down is precipitates profound experience of grieving. And profound experience of normal grieving. We may not have lost a family member. We might not have somebody ill in our family, but having our whole world turned upside down is very disorienting. Grief is the loss of the way things were. So being able to attend to listening for grief, because it often goes unrecognized in our lives. So that's one of the things I pay attention to, my own pastoral care, but also in my own life.
Yeah, that when you mentioned the word grief, as we were sharing email in preparation for this conversation, something that stood out to me is that you used the term global nightmare, and you used the word trauma. And like grief, those are such strong words that they really caught my attention. And I think that what caught my attention in your use of the word nightmare and trauma is that those things linger. They reoccur. They don't just go away when, you know, God willing, this health crisis subsides. And so I'm wondering what you might think might be the after effects of this grief and trauma, and how congregational leaders might be attentive and prepared for what might come in the aftermath of this.
So I think in terms of what pastors need to pay attention to related to nightmares and trauma, the kinds of things we need to pay attention to, that the after effects would be is people's numbness. After experience like this, people don't want to talk about it. They might just block the experience off. But the challenge with that is that when you freeze an experience, you have no access to it. And what trauma needs is, at some level, whether it's at the body level or at the conscious level, is to be processed. Of course, people need to process it in their own way. So that's the other thing I would say to pastoral leaders, is that there is really no one size fits all for processing trauma. But be attentive to people having flashbacks, people having increased levels of anxiety responses to what would be ordinary life challenges. So a profound experience of trauma will exacerbate regular life activities. So those would be some of the things I'd pay attention to. And but that's looking ahead. I think that we want to create, as pastoral leaders, as much safety as possible for people. So safety, a sense of security, a sense of groundedness helps with recovering from trauma and moving through experiences that are traumatizing. So when we keep up our regular practices in the church, not overloading them, but a regular worship practice, checking in with people, our care teams checking in with people, lay care in ways that is manageable for people, I think are all good to help lay the groundwork for not having a lot of ripple effects of trauma afterwards, but then to have our antenna up to notice those signs later on. So it's a profound question.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about what and how in this conversation, because a lot of what I have seen written as people have been trying to catch up with changing circumstances and think about how church can be in ministry in this situation, there's been a lot of advice on how. You know, use Zoom, use phone trees, use social media, but I've seen a whole lot less about the what. I really appreciate the fact that you've helped us focus on the what that we need to be attentive to and to be doing. But I wanted to go back to the how, because again, people are having to make this up as they go along, but what would be some of the tactics, strategies, practices that you would suggest for how a pastor can stay in communication with people on what is, you know, these are deep level concerns that I think people aren't used to dealing with other than in face-to-face kinds of encounters. Do you have any thoughts about what people need to be doing to create the relational space and intimacy in this new reality to really create the safety that you're talking about?
Yeah, maybe some of it has to do with putting, I mean, again, this makes use of technology again, and I'm growing weary of the level of technology, and growing weary of the all the possibilities for connection in a time when I really need to be kind of focused on some basic practices. So while I think it's good to have Zoom connections and maybe we can create chat rooms and spaces where, and they could be limited to maybe like we always suggest for actual support groups in churches, that there can be some places that where there's create closed space where it's not just open to everybody. So you might have a space where only youth group members can connect, or only resingled older adults or aging adults. But, so we have to think about how we would do that. But I think having a support group environment can be helpful because people have shared concerns in a common domain.
That's a great suggestion.
But making it available, but not having this heavy expectation everybody needs to participate.
Right.
Because that's where I'm feeling this. I'm just speaking personally right now. I have this association suggests that I could do this webinar. And this association says, well, reconnect with us. We have this to offer. So it's all these possibilities. But really, is I think a practice of saying no to some of those things is really
right.
I personally need to know. And I think pastoral leaders could be helpful for their congregants to give people permission to say, you know, we're here, we're doing okay, we're going to connect with the groups that we can connect with, and we'll give you some indication of that, but that we don't all have to be checking in all the time about everything.
Right.
It might be a practice that will kind of lower the anxiety and stress on people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is good advice because it does kind of seem like just a barrage of new kinds of experiences, and that in and of itself is a little bit overwhelming. I'm finding, anyways. So,
yeah.
Let me shift focus a little bit and ask about spiritual and religious resources that might be helpful to people in this type of need.
Yes, it was just before our school closed because of the pandemic. The previous class, I opened the class discussion with Psalm 46, which is, of course, a resource of a spiritual psalm that is a beneficial resource for me, a go-to place that I read over and over and over again. And I stopped and asked the class about the psalm, and I said, you know, the stillness that we're invited to here is not in the midst of a peaceful environment. The stillness that we're called to or that God is present to is even in the midst of the nations tottering and the people at war and the world basically caving in. So I think the psalms, the reading the psalms of lament maybe are a spiritual resource in a time like this, feeling it gives us the vehicle and avenue for expressing our grief and our pain is beneficial. Reading the Bible, my parents are funny. They go to church and they say, the pastor said, well, we should come to Bible study and read our Bibles. And my dad said, well, we do that. What else can we do?
Right. Yeah.
but also that can be, so it's a resource, but how do we do it? And how does it fit into our day? And maybe there just, I want to suggest a spiritual resource, maybe just meditating on a piece of scripture. Or a spiritual phrase. The phrase that helped me go to sleep the other night was just saying, release this, O God. Let there be release. So the word, for some reason, the word release was a very helpful religious, spiritual practice for me. Letting go, letting be, moving out of the head and having to think. So how to use the Bible and our own, well, that spiritual practices would be being mindful again, back to our own bodies. What's called for? Do we feel our heart racing? Do we feel tension in our bodies? Do we feel aching stomachs? How to let those resources be a guide for how we're going to access how we respond to God and the Holy. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say one of the things that I'm kind of picking up in my own congregation as people are, you know, sharing from their own homes and as our pastors are teaching and preaching from their home settings, I think there's been a real interest in setting up personal devotional space in some place in your home. Now, some people maybe already have that, but I think a lot of people don't. And I think that this particular crisis has kind of created an interest in people having a dedicated space in their home that they can create their own little altar or their own significant, you know, things that they want to have as touchstones in a time of meditation or spirituality. And that's something I don't think I ever would have thought of doing before. And yet all of a sudden, I think people are very interested in that.
Where I set up my own devotional space in my own home, it's facing the back window in the living room. Mm-hmm. It has a chair and candle. My Bible sits there with the lection, with the, what is the, this day, a Wesleyan way of prayer that I make use of, that Dr. Larry Stuckey produced many years ago, his special copy given to me. And then I have an icon, a Byzantine icon that a Roman Catholic friend of mine had given me many years ago. So it's that's a grounding practice. The body feels at rest sitting in that place, my body.
Yeah.
When I go there, I say, yeah.
I think not everybody has that. And so I think just suggesting creating a place like that in this time when people are confined to their homes, I think is an excellent, excellent suggestion for people.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's spring right now here, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. So a daffodil or two in a little vase would go a long way to adding beauty.
Mm-hmm. Let me shift gears a little bit. I wanted to ask about practical resources for dealing with emotional and mental health challenges. I'm imagining that with so many people confined to their homes and healthcare resources really, really strained right now, that a lot of people may feel that they're cut off from their normal sources that they might turn to if they needed mental health care. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts or suggestions for people who needed professional counseling or mental health treatment at this particular juncture, or for pastors who may feel that they need to refer someone, what do you think is happening at this juncture, or do we not know?
Well, I think a couple of resources. One significant resource is the National Institute of Health has a wonderful site. It's called the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH.nih.gov. And that website basically lists the different symptoms and signs of various mental health and mental illnesses. So for example, I had a class directed them to look at that site when we were studying depression. But there are other clinical diagnoses and clinical mental health problems or mental health concerns that people can get addressed in terms of resources that are offered there. Another place where there might would help people link with making referrals would be NAMI, which is the national, I can't think of what the acronym stands for, NAMI, NAMI.org. And that resource can be beneficial for pastors in terms of making some linkages for referrals. But if the first one is more offering self, is an educational resource, mm-hmm. but there'll also be ways, I think, to connect with, get access to professionals through NAMI. I used to recommend the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, but that doesn't exist anymore. Many of our pastors have done clinical pastoral education, so the ACPE website is a good go-to source for getting some context. They have an educational page there for certifying clinical supervisors, but there could be a way of connecting with some resources there. So that's www.acpe.edu. Other one was NAMI, NAMI.org, and then the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH.nih.gov are several that come to mind. Suicide hotlines need to be on the forefront of pastors' referral guidelines too. 1-800-273-TALK is the national suicide awareness hotline. So those are.
Yeah, thank you for sharing those. I think that it's really important to have those possibilities available to people in this time. To begin to draw this conversation to the close, I think where my head has been going with almost every facet of ministry that we're thinking about in this very disruptive time is, you know, what are things going to look like on the other side of this? I mean, I think maybe we're also caught up in the moment that we imagine that this is, there's more to it than it seems. But I think almost everybody I know thinks that we're never going to go back to things the way they used to be. and maybe that's presumptuous to think that, or maybe we're just caught up in our anxiety of the moment. But I wonder if you have given any thought to what might be on the other side of this, thinking about congregational care and pastoral care, and how things might be different. And what changes may come about as a result of having gone through this period of anxiety and trauma?
I think the thing that pops in my mind when you ask the question is, I think it provides, and this would be a positive outcome, and it goes back to that question that you were asking in terms of who is most in need of pastoral care. I think we're all most in need of pastoral care, and we're all most available to be pastoral care providers. So that is to say that congregations are recognizing, communities are recognizing that we're all in this place where we're feeling need, and we are also all in this place where we feel like, hopefully, some of us are rising and recognizing, I have this to offer. So I think if we come out realizing at the end of this process, this experience, that we have both a lot to give and a lot to receive as communities, I think that would be a positive outcome.
Yeah.
Of course, living with an increased level of anxiety is not good, not helpful, but to have our consciousness raised to realize how vulnerable we are as human beings, to how fragile and vulnerable we are, can connect us with the least of these, whatever that means to us, everywhere in the globe. So we're all, I think that can be a connecting point. But then unfortunately, the negative side would be we begin to build walls and separations and think, well, that's not my problem, which could be the negative outcome of it. If we come out more connected as human beings and communities, that's very positive.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because I think my sense is we all have become very aware of how important our communities are to us. If, you know, for those of us who are connected deeply with congregational communities, I think we're very aware of how sustaining and important and vital those connections are.
Yes.
Even when we're not in the building, which I think is an epiphany for a lot of people to realize that, you know, the church continues to be profound community, even when we're not gathering in the ways that we're used to. And I kind of think that might be a blessing in this, that we come to realize that church is more than that place that you go for an hour on Sunday morning, that there's something in the community of church that is so much bigger and more sustaining in terms of how it interfaces with our life.
Beautifully said. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me and talk with our listeners today. These are uncertain times, and I know I've been asking you questions that none of us know the answers to. So,
like I said, I'm not an expert. We're all experts. We're all novices. So I'll free myself from that burden.
I think what I have found, that one of the qualities of people who are truly expert is that they know what they don't know. And so I appreciate both your humility in that, but also the great expertise that you bring. So thank you so much for talking with us today. And I just pray that people are encouraged by your very practical and thoughtful words in this difficult time. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Anne.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Bishop Yehiel Curry of the Metropolitan Chicago Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. The bishop offers his insights on leadership development.
First of all, be coachable. And what I mean by that is sometimes the assumed teacher becomes the student. My mother, Regina Curry, always calls it co-learning. So whenever you go into an environment, even if you're the assumed teacher, you find yourself at moments where a 10-year-old has taught you something new through an example. So one of the characteristics for me is always, it doesn't matter how old we are, we have to be willing to receive some new learning from an adult, from a youth. So that's the first key for me.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.